I'm going to start by telling you about an anecdote about a little experience I had recently. I was in Berlin talking about the same projects that I've been doing, and it was on the occasion of an exhibition that was happening, organized by the Neue Nationalgalerie, the State Museum in Germany, bringing works from the Tehran Museum of Contemporary Arts to Berlin. And this had been in the make for a long time, and we had been in conversations, and I had been sort of recruited as a writer for a catalogue that was going to be a shadow catalogue to the official catalogue, because the official catalogue of that exhibition was very state-controlled. And the museum curators began to get a bit anxious that it's not going to be a very interesting catalogue if it was going to be really controlled by state, so that they were going to have a shadow catalogue. And the excuse was that they often publish two things rather than one, or two books rather than one. And so they recruited me and several other people to write in the shadow catalogue. For me, it was important because my work is sort of in the shadows anyway. And I was rather a little bit concerned about being published in the shadow as opposed to just being in the shadow. And but it all worked out, so I went ahead and did my work. So the conference happened, but what happened was that the exhibition never happened because the works of art never arrived from the Tehran Museum of Contemporary Arts. It was a big diplomatic thing. Of course, it would have been a huge coup for any European institution to have the Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art museum bringing 60 works from the museum out of Iran. And of course, this museum, the works haven't really been shown that much over the last 40 years. Anyway, it didn't happen. What happened was that we were there for the conference, and I was in this empty room where the exhibition would have been hanging. So we were in the phantom of the exhibition, amongst the ghosts of the would-be artworks, doing the talk. But for me, it was a great moment, because the emptiness of the hall and the eerie white sort of empty space was really resonating with the kind of work I do, because I thought that the absence is telling me a lot more than if the artworks were there. This is not to put the artworks down or the project in any way to kind of diminish the project, but in my kind of work that I'm doing, the absence and the erasure and the kind of invisible becomes actually sometimes a lot more interesting. So I've been focusing on these areas of the invisible. So this was a really poignant moment for me. And I thought the omissions become almost monumental. And that this kind of the omission, this omitted exhibition actually is a monument itself. And that we can be witness to the invisible, if you like. And to investigate these absences and these erasures are very much what I want to do. So I'm going to take you to what I've been doing for the last few years, which is that in the context of this think tank research space that I created called the Archaeology of the Final Decade, which is a non-profit space, I've been researching areas of culture that have been condemned. So they've been condemned politically, historically, or they've just remained obscure. But in general, they are material that have been removed from circulation, and they're no longer available to us. Sometimes this removal is very determined, so that there is a kind of banning and a censorship, and sometimes it goes to the point of being destroyed, material have been destroyed. So this forensic excavation that I've been doing is about making visible what has been unavailable. And I've been focusing, I realize, over the years, working and being in contact with different projects and different people and collaborating with different academics and museums, I've been realizing that actually what I've really been working on are areas that have endured violence. So I will be looking more in the future about what this all means about violence. But I think these areas have experienced violence, and the violence has been long-term, kind of durational. And So what I've also noticed is that the areas that I've been interested in have been targeted usually because they were already rich in information, usually because they were already contested, usually because they were already special in some way, I think. And somebody somewhere decided that they had to be removed anyway. So the fact that we don't have access to them is actually already, because the object in itself was already quite potent. But what I've understood, what I've been thinking about recently, is that these areas, I now see them as micro-ecologies of trauma of some sort, that if I tap into them, they kind of hold zip files of information, so that they begin to release a huge amount of information. And I think even on a kind of personal trauma level, medically or neurologically, actually, that's also true, that when you have been exposed to a very traumatic situation, the information that's absorbed by the brain is quite massive, actually. So if you ask somebody to explain a two-minute traumatic event, it'll take them half an hour to explain it, because actually the information absorbed is, in a way, I'm calling it like it's stored in a zip file situation. So when you click on it, it kind of opens into a huge number of files. So I've been thinking about all of this. I'm just sharing with you the kind of things I've been thinking. But what basically we want to do, I've been doing, is that these subterranean areas, I think, are ripe for excavation. And that's what I've been working on. And that this excavation is about retrieving the material, reintegrating those objects into memory and into cultural arenas and discourse, and also doing a horizontal investigation into how they were made, when they were made, what kind of connections and disconnections they have with other areas of reality. And there are kind of a few points I want to pick up on, which is that one thing I've really realized by putting my work out is that a lot of people are interested in this shedding light on dark spots of history. Some institutions in the UK have been interested in shedding light on other geographies and histories from the elsewhere, so to speak. I mean, I am from the elsewhere, so I kind of don't really associate myself with that sort of thing, but that is what has come to me. But also, I kind of, first of all, I see it as a counter performance towards the erasure. So if something is not there and you're actually retrieving it and putting it back there, you're kind of counter performing the performance that somebody had already put in place some time, which was like to erase and to eradicate and take away. And what we want to do, of course, is to open up new perspectives of seeing. Sometimes these perspectives, I've realized, actually go beyond the intention of the artwork, because the core of all these investigations usually is a cultural product or an artwork or an art object or a cultural object. But when you start to extrapolate horizontally, I've understood that sometimes it goes beyond the original intention within which the artwork was created, the original impulse. And of course, if you dig deep enough and if you go rummaging around enough, you will obviously begin to dismantle some narrative, a narrative that already created that condition. You will begin to dismantle it. And I'm really happy that I'm here able to share this evening with Professor Irit Rogoff, because we've spoken about this on several occasions in the past, and one of the ideas she came up with was the idea of the supplement that she planted in my mind, which was how you can focus on a particular area, on what would be effectively supplementary, a small area, which in my kind of work is able then to dismantle the bigger entity. So I'm looking, for example, let's say at the red light district of Tehran, how it was and what happened to it. It's literally a supplementary area, even urban terms, in terms of where it was in the city of Tehran, etc. But its history, its landscape, and the violence it endured will tell us a lot more and dismantle a lot more about the bigger picture, the bigger condition that we live in. This is one of the things that has come up, but also, I mean, then this leads me to this dismantling of dominant narratives, but also just to complexify. So another project I'm going to talk about is the Festival of Arts. And usually when there is this kind of erasure, there's a kind of clean closure, like this object was X, Y, and Z, good, usually good, bad, quite monolithic. And of course, when you reintegrate it and you take it away from 1960s or 1970s and reinsert it back into discourse in year 2017, you're bound to, and hopefully if you do it in the right way, you are going to initiate a system of a multiplicity of narratives and systems of statements, so that you complexify the nature of the object. You're actually not trying to resolve the problem, you're not trying to say it's good or bad, you're actually trying to complexify it. And actually I found the more complex it is, the more interesting it is. So these are some points I wanted to share with you before I go into one of the projects, which is based on the archives I've been retrieving around the Festival of Al-Shiraz Persepolis. It was a festival that happened in Iran from 1967 to 1977, 11 years, and for a festival performance of its kind is actually quite a long time, especially at that time. And it came to an abrupt end in 1978, in the sense that the actual history is that it was actually set up for happening in 1978, but it never happened in 1978. It was programmed, but it never happened. Rewind, on 28th of September 1977, there had been a fatwa, a religious decree by Ayatollah Khomeini, who later takes over the mantle of power in Iran. But this is 1977. Demonstrations haven't even started in Iran. He actually delivered a fatwa, and I've actually discovered this date very recently, so I'm very happy about that. But he delivered this fatwa in 1977 in September, at the time when the festival usually happened, declaring it un-Islamic. So it was targeted already at that time. So it came to an abrupt end in 1978 because the organizers were too nervous to bring an international crowd into Tehran, which was already at that time quite volatile. Now, I have picked up a few things to talk about. One of the things, basically to tell you about it, is that the festival was mainly a performance-based festival. So it was music, dance, drama, theater of all kinds. And it happened in many locations. It happened in the city of Shiraz, in many different locations, like a shrine, the TV studios, a stadium, the streets, the bazaar, and also in nature around the city of Shiraz, and also in the ruins of Persepolis, which was the seat of the Persian Empire 6th century BC. So it was a very loaded and symbolic place, but also aesthetically beautiful space, epically useful for theatre people. So if we move away from the politics of it and from the politics of empire, etc., all the theatre people would tell you that it, scenographically it was just the most amazing space. And I'm going to show you, hopefully if we can get this to work, yes, a collage of videos that will show you, give you a little insight into the space. Wait, is there no sound on this? Hello? There's no sound? Oh, there's no sound. Yeah? I could go back and start again. Yeah.
which was viewed more sentimental than professional. I think that we should keep our traditional music. And of course, I think that the influence of the Western music would be inevitable.
So that was just a kind of a mosaic of videos that I've managed to find, because all the performances, as far as I know, were recorded, video recorded and audio recorded, and that the actual recordings are not available to us. So this is the stuff that I've been able to piece together as a puzzle over the last 6 or 7 years. Just a few things I want to pick out here is that, as you kind of saw in the space of this festival happening in the 60s and 70s, there was a kind of a vision to accommodate pluralistically different, very different trajectories and very different spaces of culture and aesthetics. So the festival really aimed almost precociously, but very consciously anyway, to place African and Asian impulses and traditions and arts, performing arts, on an equal footing to the European one. And it played a very, very big role in attempting to dismantle a kind of Eurocentric, even Eurogenetic an attitude to culture. And also, in doing so, it also straddled all kinds of dichotomies of what's tradition and what's contemporary, what's relevant and what's not relevant, what's alien and what's self. But it was straddling huge difficulties and huge areas of, let's say, difficult binaries of not just the so-called first world, third world, but the ex-colonizers and the newly decolonized. But even the Cold War of the Eastern European, Western European, and also what they were very interested in is finding a kind of a good balance between introducing, let's say, Asian components of performing cultures, music, theatre, that are very steeped in history and steeped in tradition. The Kathakali performance, Indian performance, is around 2,000 years old. But actually placing it next to Mass Cunningham or placing it next to a contemporary piece of drama was very much part of their kind of investigation as to how that is possible and that how that can be meaningful. So I've picked out a few things to just quickly tell you, but what's very important is that the Iranian performers were highest in number, largest in number, because there was this kind of mythology in the absence of the archive that this was a kind of imperial project and oil money thrown at Americans and thrown at Europeans. And I found by looking at the project that it was a much more complicated and complex space. For one thing, the Iranians, and then the secondary Iranians were the Indian performers. They were the biggest. And it's very interesting that in the catalogues, they actually mention that we must look at India and Japan as Iranians to see whether we have something to offer to the international landscape of performing arts and culture, because they thought that the Japanese and the Indians had done a good job of it. And then after India, it's very interesting for me, France and America are great. And we come to that because of the avant-garde component of the festival, of course, Paris and New York. I picked out a few themes that I'll quickly go through, but in 1969, they really began to articulate a sophisticated strategy. In order to equalize across the cultures, they said, why don't we just do percussion for music? So they managed to create a space where European musicians were happy to admit, if you like, that some Africans and some Asians, especially Indians, were highly sophisticated in percussion in a way that the European tradition of music had not actually explored. So it was a kind of very sophisticated, and they managed to put juxtapose quite a few different types of people together. For example, the Rwandan drum ensemble with the Balinese gamelan concerts, with the Iranian percussionists, here you see the Iranian ones, with the French, Greek-French composer Yannis Zanakis, who was a communist who had fled Greece during the military rule in Greece, and he was in Paris, and the jazz percussionist, the American Max Roach. So this is Yannis Zanakis, and this is the percussion ensemble from Strasbourg playing his piece called Persephassa. This is Max Roach. You saw them in the film. You saw Max Roach on the drums, having a jamming session with the Iranians. They kind of had the opportunities to have sort of fun together as well. This is the Rwandans. You saw in the film the Rwandans were somehow, I think, having a rehearsal or some kind of a warm-up session, and you saw the nomadic people around them, and they were going the, I don't know what's called in English, they were doing that. It was really an incredible piece of film. Another theme that we picked out was how some people were interested in, and I decided to include this, about this kind of modernities looking elsewhere, so that the story of modern modernities from the elsewhere and other geographies wasn't always a cut-and-paste situation from looking to Europe, Eastern, Western, or the Americas, but actually in the space of Shiraz Persepolis, they were very distinctly looking to Asia and Africa to rediscover what it means, and to actually employ certain facilities or certain trajectories or certain modes of art to be modern. It was not actually to go back to tradition, but it was actually to push forward into a contemporary space. And this really was interesting to me because I was also very interested in drama. It came up through my projects, which was that when you look at the space of Shiraz Persepolis, it really allows a platform for a lot of third worlders, and they call them third world performers, who were really basing their investigations and their creations in a compost of their native cultures, very, very seriously looking at their native rituals and traditions and folklores. And it was a kind of a striving for authenticity that was running across the newly decolonized world in Asia and Africa and Latin America. And so these performers found an ally in the internationally fluid avant-garde, which were in Shiraz Persepolis from Western Europe and Eastern Europe and America, the USA, and from Japan. Japan was the only Asian country that produced that had a link at the Shiraz Festival, had a link to the international avant-garde. So this fluid international avant-garde was very interested in creating a link with these traditional, primitive, native impulses, etc., for their own reasons. So it really became interesting as a nexus, where the modernizing nativists meet the ritualizing modernists. Because, of course, the type of modernists from East, Western Europe and America who were coming were actually, in a way, ritualizing. So Jerzy Grotowski, you may know or you may not know of him, but a Polish theater practitioner who believed in the sacred. I mean, people were transcendental. John Cage was interested in Zen Buddhism, Stockhausen was interested in Hinduism. They were interested in those spaces. Now, we can look at that in a different way today, but they were a very serious interest they had. So I'm going to show you some more pictures. This is Jerzy Grotowski, whose theatre pieces were very ritualized. Only 35 people could be in the audience, so it was a very condensed space. And the actor, every word was enacted in the body of the actor. And he was very interested in India. He may have even died in India, Jerzy Grotowski. He was Polish. Then from that year on, they moved on to theatre and ritual, which was also very interesting for them because of all this, what I was explaining to you earlier, the interest in ritual from both sides. And these are other pictures from it. The Bread and Puppet Theatre from America that insisted on performing in the streets and insisted on reading a declaration to human rights outside of a prison. And they were allowed to do that in Shiraz, outside of the prison in Shiraz, which did hold political prisoners as well. And this is them again. They also spread bread amongst the audience. It was a very sort of ritualized, ceremonial type of performance. They spread bread and they always had masks. And they're very left-wing American. They still exist. Bread and Puppet Theatre. This is Jerzy Grotowski's The Constant Prince, written by Calderón, the Spanish. This is Nuria Espert from Spain performing Les Bonnes, Jean Genet. Jean Genet was considered ritual enough to be part of this ritual. And she said to me that Shiraz Persepolis with a breath of fresh air can compare to Franco Spain. So we're going to Ziani Zanakis having left Greece, and she talking about Spain. So of course, Spain, Greece, Portugal were under dictatorships. And this led to other creations like this, Orgast. So I'm going to zip through this. We're talking here about the avant-garde facilitating the reversal of knowledge from, let's say, Asia into the European sphere. This is a performance of Mantra by Stockhausen, two pianos in the bazaar in Shiraz. This is Stockhausen himself. A little glimpse of the audience. We don't have many pictures of the audience. Another performance by Stockhausen, the Merce Cunningham Company. This is John Cage. This is the Stockhausen performance. This is Car Mountain by Bob Wilson. You saw the very slow black and white film. It was 168 hours long. And it started on Friday and ended the next Friday. The Balinese Gamelan, they featured several times over the years. They were very important. They also made a link to Artaud, because Antonin Artaud was very important to the Shiraz curators. He had the Balinese had left a huge mark in France in the 1889 Colonial Expo. It's very famous, a very interesting space to study. The Katakali Indians. The case of Africa is very interesting because, of course, there was the World Festival of Negro Arts in Dakar in 1966 and the Pan-African Cultural Festival in Algiers in 1969 that the Shiraz Festival gets linked to in some ways. And this is the Ballet National du Sénégal that I believe had left Senegal for the first time to come to Shiraz. The Balinese again. Shuji Torayama from Japan. Shuji Torayama's production. Theater Stu from Poland, and an Iranian production of Albert Camus' Caligula. And this is my last point of the festival, which is that looking at the space of the festival, what becomes really important and helpful in trying to understand it is that it seems to have existed outside the dominant discourses. Politically, outside the demarcations that existed. Theatrically, tapping into modes of theatre that were not the usual ones, but also in terms of the story of modernism, there is a kind of hyper-modernist or a super-modernist layer, it seems, up there, where somebody in Senegal was in contact with somebody in Japan, who was in contact with somebody in Poland, was in contact with somebody in America. And this is actually somehow beyond the general story of modernism, the way we see institutions today in the so-called center, where we live in London, interested in using as a focus, as a lens to look at the rest of the world. This is yet another level of modernism. It's not the same as the one that produces the exhibitions like Choquet at the Tate, which is like very interesting, but in very direct relationship to kind of modernism, if you like, that abstraction of modernism. This is a sort of different layer, which I'm very interested in. And then another project I want to quickly go through is this project based on an archive of photographs that were done by Kaveh Golestan, a documentary photographer in Iran, where he documented the prostitutes of the red light district in Tehran between 1975 and 1977. I'll show you these, some of the images that he created. These are the last existing documents of the residents of the red light district of Tehran. The 61 vintage prints, which he printed out of some 200 and something photographs that he took. Some of them are very composed. Some of them are more spontaneous. They show a great amount of interesting detail in the backgrounds, pop stars, pornography. So what I did was that I decided excavate, because these photographs had not been shown since 1978, so nobody had seen them. And I thought they were very interesting photographs, but they were also aesthetically very powerful, compositionally very interesting, and just as artworks, extremely powerful objects themselves. But around them, I decided to do what you see here, which was to extrapolate an immense amount of information around the context of the area itself and its significance in terms of the bigger picture. And this is a sort of typical thing that we do as the archaeology of the final decade. So the artwork's on the wall, but then I kind of interject by having my own thread. And these are the kind of documents, these are the kind of vitrines that I created here. And I'll show you some of the documents. This was a map of the area itself, which is the red dot in the corner there. So the area was always intertwined with politics. It was actually founded because the prostitutes had been expelled from the city of Tehran, and the city of Tehran used to have walls around it like an ancient city would. all the way down to in early 1920s. And the red dot is outside the city, and then it becomes part of the city. And this is a photograph, I don't know the date of it, by a different photographer, Ali Khadem. It shows, you can see a bare-chested woman in the courtyard, and there's a man at the entrance looking into the courtyard. So this is how the red light district used to operate. After the coup d'etat in 1953, the CIA, British-backed coup d'etat that removed the democratic government of Prime Minister Mozabe, then the military regime that followed the coup d'etat decided to put up a wall, to create a wall around the area. I believe that it was kind of through an American-informed idea of cleaning up the space. And there was a gate down here that would let you. So it kind of enshrined it as a ghetto. What happened, what I then extracted from it later on, was that the emancipation of women, the equal rights, etc., created a very interesting social change in Iran. And women's organizations and the School of Social Work, headed by Saptar Ifama Farmayan, an Iranian woman, did a huge amount of work in that space. And the fact that it had been ghettoized, that the wall had been created around it, actually really helped them to be able to tap into the space. So a clinic was created in it, a police station was created in it, and courses and classes, literacy classes, etc., were created for the prostitutes inside the space. This was very important for me. These are images from a film that was commissioned by the women's organization at the time to document the space. Then what we extracted was information that was very important, because the space was burnt down 2 days before the arrival of Ayatollah Khomeini in Tehran. And I found the newspapers that document that event. And I couldn't find the date of the burning for anybody. Even the journalists who had documented the fire could not give me the date of the fire. They couldn't even give me the date whether it was prior to the fall of the monarchy or post the fall of the monarchy. So it was like a Bastille Day kind of day in the Iranian historical thing. And nobody could give me the date. This amnesia was very important for me. Anyway, I found this, which says on the right-hand side, vast preparations for the arrival of the Imam, the Saint Khomeini. And on the left, it says that west and south of Tehran burn in the flames of fire. So the two pieces of news are juxtaposed next to each other. It's really interesting. I don't really have to do anything, because they're all there together on the front page. So the vast preparations for the arrival of the Imam is juxtaposed against west and south of Tehran burning the flame of fires. And underneath it, the smaller text says, the red light district, the cabarets, and the drinking houses, and the beer factories, all in one fire. This is the inside page with more pictures of it, and then these are some of the pictures that I got from the photographs, from the photographers. The picture above shows, you may be able to see, a head on the, it's basically a charred body being carried, a head on the left-hand side, the torso, the hips, the knees, and the foot. And it's, the photographer claims that it was alleged to be one of the burnt prostitutes, because nobody took notice of how many prostitutes may have died in the fire. Nobody took responsibility for the fire either. It was just a cleaning of the palette. This is another picture. That's by Abbas, the Magnum photographer, Iranian, and the lower one is by Kamran Shirdel. This is by Kamran Shirdel. And these are other pictures of it, of the burning. And then I recovered newspapers about the execution of the prostitutes, because the first women to be executed post-revolution in Iran were the prostitutes of the Red Light District. And it was announced in the newspaper, and three of them were named, and one of them is pictured there. So So the executions of these women, and this is the Amnesty International record of it, marks the initiation of executions of women after the revolution in Iran. But recently, the research has expanded itself, and I've understood that it's actually the initiation of the execution of women in Iran, full stop, in modern Iran. I.e., the Iranian modern judiciary had not condemned women to death prior to this moment, except for one case, and I have the name, and there may be two other cases prior to 1979. But post-1979, there are thousands of women who have been executed, and now the space looks like this. So it has been cleaned, demolished, I mean it was burnt, and then it was demolished, and then it has been cleansed, turned into a park, no scars, no residue of the trauma, the violence, no memory left, and it looks very healthy, and usually there are geese and lovely swans. And this re-territorialization is a very important point, where the system completely cleanses and re-territorializes the space. And the last three images I want to show you are of Kaveh Golestan's wife, the photographer's wife, who documented the demonstrations against the imposition of the veil in Iran. This is another project that I'm working on. And this happened right after the revolution, when the veil was imposed. And Hengameh Golestan, who's the photographer here, documents the vast demonstrations that happened against this imposition, which has gone actually, it's not erased, but it's pretty forgotten. So this is another project that I'll be working on. And I'm going to end there. Thank you.
One or two meta terms to Vali's discussion. I've been following Vali's work for the last 3 or 4 years, and last year I'm part of a collective called Free Thought, and we were the curators of the Bergen Assembly, which is the Norwegian Triennial, and we're a collective of six. We work both together and on individual projects. Our project was on infrastructure. I had decided to assemble a series of unrelated archives under the aegis of a notion of archives of substance. Can substance be archived? Which is sort of, I think, remains an open question. And one of the archives that I invited was Vali's archive of the Shiraz Persepolis Festival. So we've been in conversation around both of these projects for a few years now. And I think maybe one thing that I want to sort of think about, because you're so inside all of this, right? And every time I hear it, you've dug up another 5 facts that are sort of new and hair-raising. And I suppose what I want to ask is about the way in which there's an event or a series of events. There is a kind of dismantled archive due to a series of other political events. And then there's your impulse to reconstitute something, which is in part about, you know, the kind of lost documentation of what happened. But it's a lot more than that, because it's a political act. The impulse to reconstitute a lost or dispersed archive is a political act. And what gets produced is a dissonant archive, right? It's not a passive archive. It's not an archive that sits there and kind of reconstitutes everything that happened at that event or that series of events. It's an archive that begins to produce something of its own at another level, which is a form of sort of dissonance. So I suppose the kind of first question is really about your relation to dissonant archives, rather, because it's not nostalgia for something that happened or kind of mythologizing of what happened, but it's clearly the deployment, a kind of a militating with some historical materials in order to produce a certain dissonance. So, and maybe that's the first question I want to ask you.
Yes, as Irene said, we have been in contact for a few years, and it's every time exciting for me, because the ideas that come up from our conversations are always very liberating. I could say that when I first started the project, in fact, some people labelled it as nostalgia, apparently as though one is trying to present an era of history that was happier and better and more liberal than what we live in a nostalgic way. But that wasn't my position in it at all. Originally, I came to the Shiraz Festival project because I have translated several Persian plays into English, and we staged them at the Royal Court Theatre and at the Barbican. And I created a conference, a one-day conference at the Barbican, that proved to be extremely difficult to do, because the Iranians wouldn't want to sit at the same table with each other, those who were outside, those who were inside, those who were from the past, those who were from the now. And this discord, this internal strife, this internal impossibility for us to kind of actually sit together and be part of an artistic community was an initial sort of shocking moment for me. And it led me into doing my own research into these spaces to try to find out what's happening. And of course, everything you touch, once it's been through this kind of furnace of some totalitarianly imposed, some kind of imposition of an ideology, that everything is transformed. Nothing is quite as it really is in real. So what I found, Irit, was that I don't know if I've specifically been doing this or it's been doing it to me. Because whatever you touch, if you want to go deep enough, you reach the same space. It's somewhere along the line, the real connections and the abstract connections are problematic for different people or a state or a kind of monologue that's imposed upon it. So it becomes, dare I say, even a militant space. But I don't shy from it, because I think that has become a very important thing for me. And I realized that everything I was really interested in was problematic. So the problem, basically, I didn't come to it from a theory. I came to it because I was interested in the portraits, and I was deeply interested in the theater, because I was involved in theater. I did scenography and I translated plays. So I came to these areas from practice, not from theory. Yeah? But they have led you to the same place, because I think if you dig deep enough, you end up there. Or yeah. I don't know.
Well, you know, that's work that's worth doing. Work that does something to you, mm-hmm. isn't just directed by you, but actually kind of transforms you and rewrites your consciousness, yes. and so on. I think I was interested in the Shiraz Persepolis project because it showed me a certain model of how to think intranationally, supranationally, not nationally, which, you know, in the Middle East has been the absolute curse of the last 100 years, is the kind of ever-rising factionalism and nationalism. And the sort of way in which both of these projects, at one level, document something that took place in Iran, and at another level, begin to connect to a whole set of hardly articulated histories that transcend the kind of the local and the national. So this kind of moment of the kind of decolonization of the 1960s, where the sort of threads and connections get made between emergent cultures that are in the process of decolonization, in order to kind of forge some kind of reciprocity around the fact that they're not just mimicking the West, but they actually have kind of not just ancient traditions, but actually complex modern kind of processes. I think for me, it reminded me of, you know, the way in which the Marxist International of the 1970s thought of itself beyond nations. And so it was the fact that it kind of transcended. It's constantly transcending what is being documented. And that's where I find it extremely interesting.
I think your mentioning of this, the Marxist International, is interesting, because in many ways the Shiraz space is very much anti-globalization in the way we see it today. Mm-hmm. It's very much more an internationalist space and not a globalizing or a globalized space in the way we see it today. Yeah. Because they are meant to be distinct and separate, but unified in some kind of drive or in some kind of impulse or in some kind of instinct, but not in form and content. And you see what I mean? In the deeper, it's a kind of either very transcendental or very elemental, but it's not actually to transform everything into some kind of unified, globalized culture at all. They actually mention it, which is very interesting. They say it's not about that. Yeah. And this is really quite early for them to be talking about that. Mm-hmm. So it fits into this internationalism in that...
I think there was, across the post-colonial emergent world, there were incredibly sophisticated discourses, and it's the West that kept simplifying them and making them banal. And of course, the West, in this as in everything else, can only see things in relation to itself, right? So what is decolonization but a resistance to Western colonialism? But it's, of course, about far more, and far more sort of interesting and innovative. I suppose the other thing that I find kind of interesting, and we'll see where it goes, because I can see that even since the last time we did this, which was, I think, in September, it's kind of already moved on, is how the sort of work on the citadel is beginning to transcend Iranian history into a kind of... an invocation of a whole set of human statuses that are, you know, where the status is not quite as human as it should be. And the sort of way in which the veil can't be boxed into Iranian history as the veil, right? It's there's this huge demonstration, there's a clear manifestation, there's the beginning of the execution of women, but the sort of obviously it kind of connects with sort of a much bigger history, which is an emancipatory history that has setbacks all the time. And it's I suppose I want to ask you that, and then maybe we'll open it up, which is, when and how is a setback the optimal way of understanding something happening, right? Because we could kind of talk about this as incredibly tragic moments of repression. Yes. But, and thinking from the perspective of this kind of faux archivist, which you've become, I think you keep finding potential in setbacks, and I wanted to ask about that. Does that make sense as a question?
Yes, in some ways. I think you call them, I mean, setbacks is, I have to think about what you mean by setbacks, because I call them traumas or spaces of violence. And I think there is no way to turn attention away from or trivialize the trauma itself as an event or as a reality. And hence, from that, what becomes has become a bit of a driving force for me, partly in the face of resistances, partly in the face of patrons who don't want to help a project like that, or institutions who want to sanitize projects like that, is actually that my responsibility as an observer and my interest in, to use your word, militating or initiating, instigating an affect in the audience with whom I'm in contact through an exhibition or something like that. And in all of that, it's become as sort of narrow as it might sound, right, that I'm very interested in pointing the finger, the culprits. I'm sorry to say that, but it's become like that for me. I remember when a police officer once said to me, if a lady is walking down the street, and, I mean lady, just for the sake of it, and is intoxicated with alcohol, vulnerable, not able to necessarily, with not all her faculties with her, at her disposal because of alcohol, she's wearing not very appropriate clothing, she's not wearing appropriate shoes to be able to kind of run away or defend herself, and she's walking down a very dark alley at 1 o'clock in the morning, and there's another street right parallel, it's very lit, full of people, and her friends are all walking down that road. She decides to walk down this road and she gets assaulted. The blame for the assault must never be shifted away from this, the perpetrator of the crime. Doesn't matter if she was wearing this, doesn't matter if she was vulnerable.
This is a police officer?
Yeah, it's very interesting. No? The UK. Very, very high ground. Yes. I learned a lot from it. Mm-hmm. But the blame should never be shifted away from the perpetrator of the crime. Yes, all those conditions existed. There were maybe there were mistakes, there are vulnerabilities, etc., etc. So what I've found in my projects is it's actually very difficult to discuss them in an Iranian context because people have a lot of ifs and buts and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's not easy. I'm not trying to be that clear, mm-hmm. and that I'm not dogmatic about it, mm-hmm. but the situation is quite clear. And there are lots of alibis, and there are lots of excuses, and there are lots of, oh, there was the shirt, the skirt was too short, you know. Mm-hmm. The space was very exploitative of the red light district anyway, it was very degrading anyway, all that. Or the Shiraz Festival was a little bit over the top, and there were sort of lots of leggings and lots of leotards, lots of excuses. Mm-hmm. Do you see? That's what I've come up with.
No, I think I meant something else.
Yes, I'm sure you did. I wanted to mention
which
that.
Is that there is this discourse around the veil and the repressiveness of the veil. Mm. But if you think about the history of women in Iran in the 20th century, it's a modernist history, it's a quite emancipated history. Mm. It's kind of a parallel, let's say, to Kemalist Turkey, to various kind of modernizing societies that are not in the West. And but it's the setback of the repression by this particular regime that begins to kind of draw your attention to the fact that there is this long and emancipatory history.
Yes.
Yeah. And that this is a very particular form of political repression,
yes.
And its victims are largely women.
Yes.
And so that's what I'm calling a setback. There's a setback has this kind of extraordinary ability to show you a much bigger picture beyond itself. And this is the thing about these archives, is that they're constantly doing that. Mm. They're showing bigger pictures beyond themselves. That's why I was talking about the supplement, right? So the archive is the supplement that then makes the kind of the general,
yes,
more visible, more available. And the sort of, so I'm kind of thinking the ambition of all of these things is that they are deceptive in a way, because their ambition is much greater than they are. And
they were not born like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a reflection of the conditions or the forces against which we operate.
Yeah.
So because I have found that, for example, a lot of institutions have been interested in my projects, but very much from the perspective of, oh, let's tick the box of some art historical research from another geography. And I've sometimes ended up in bed for like 3 weeks because it's actually not at all what I wanted to do. And the way the thing actually then is displayed is very far removed from the impulses I had, or even the emotions I've involved in it, or even the intellect I've involved in it at all. So the process has made them like that. And
this is where it gets really interesting, because this is why I keep saying, what's the impulse to archive?
Yeah.
It's not to document what happened, or not exclusively, or that's a starting point and then other things begin to happen. And it needs to be kind of, I think, really articulated as a practice in the present, mm-hmm, not the you know, resuscitation, yes, of something historical that was lost. Mm-hmm. It's, yes, a practice in the present. And it's once you've got all the documentation of what happened there that you can get your hands on, that doesn't make the practice finished.
No.
You know, it continues to kind of develop and elaborate.
Yes, it's definitely. I never set out to do any archives at all. But one of the ways it's happened is that people have been interested in archives, so they've actually forced me into presenting an archive, and then I've said, that's not enough. The archive needs to be performed, mm-hmm, needs to do something, needs to deliver some information, needs to expand some knowledge, needs to actually be affective. I want people to be affected by what they see. So I was never meant to be an artist, but it's happened like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, okay, final question, and that's really about this haunted landscape of the citadel that was, and the fact that there are no markings there of what it was. There's a complete erasure, right? It's elided from the sort of... Do you think that toxic histories make landscapes perform in a different way?
Landscapes being...
The sort of...
Physical.
I'm sort of wondering how the toxicity of that particular landscape is performing through the people that inhabit it today, even if they don't know what happened there. Mm-hmm.
Well, there are a few quick answers or disclaimers here. For one thing, it's a park, so actually nobody lives in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a vast park, there's a hospital and there's a lake. So actually they've not developed it for people to live in. In my research, in my investigating into the area, and into the general new generations of Tehran's population with the area,
mm-hmm,
I have to say, impressively, erasure works. Erasure works.
We know that erasure works.
I don't think there is much to go on in that way at all. To the extent that even these photographs of women demonstrating in the streets of Iran under the plane trees, if I go back, I can show you there. I've found that younger Iranians feel physically nervous when they watch it, especially if they're girls, because they have never seen an urban space like that in their own country. And it physically upsets them, affects them. Mm-hmm. I mean, erasure is powerful if it's done in this kind of total way, if it's done in this proper way. It's very well organized.
And yet something always bubbles up.
It bubbles up. This is a very long conversation, and I'm not optimistic about the bubbles, because we see resistances focusing on removing the veil from here, from the very front of the forehead, mm-hmm. to the kind of middle back of the forehead. And that's the sort of limit.
But there's this... I was in Singapore recently, and every conversation I had, doesn't really matter with whom, academics, artists, curators, whatever, there were ghosts everywhere in every conversation. So, you know, there's a way in which the ghostly is used for that which has been erased. So it's not, it doesn't take
yes.
place in the kind of landscape of Singaporean politics, you know, from 1951 onwards, and this invention of a kind of new capitalist state and so on. The way in which you kind of bring in all kinds of erased pasts is through ghostliness. And Southeast Asia is a landscape populated with a lot of ghosts, so this is not that unusual. But again and again, when I was listening to people saying the ghosts, and I thought, right, the sort of all the things that can't be unspoken come enter it in a kind of spectral manner. And that's the bubbling up, you know, of toxic histories
mm-hmm.
that really cannot be suppressed. They
mm-hmm.
just find it's Freud's return of the repressed. It does come up in just completely
through.
Oblique ways.
Yes.
I think maybe we need to invite everybody else to speak and take some questions or comments.
I'm interested. Were you born there?
Yes.
So it's your heart, your home, in one sense.
Yes.
So I'm interested in your very refreshing take on all this. There is great feeling, but it's not emotional. There may be anger, but you're not manifesting it. You speak of the transcendental from time to time. I'm just... It's a very subtle approach, which I'm not actually that used to in the... Well, in any world, as the art world or anything else. And can you give a clue as to where that stance might come from? Maybe... It's so personal, you don't want to, but I'm just intrigued by your lightness of touch, really,
mm-hmm.
but seriousness at the same time.
Good to hear his feedback. I think it's not a constructed relationship to my work or attitude, but I think a kind of an intelligent distance is necessary when you can't, in some ways you can't do much about what is out there, but you are very concerned and you really want to do something about what's out there. So you have to understand that there are forces beyond your engagement, let alone control, etc. So you do what you can, but you intelligently, hopefully, and in an engaged manner, but you must keep a distance from it. And you can't get consumed by it. It's not a cause, but it's a passion, if that makes sense.
But you are obviously having, in a very subtle way, having a profound effect. I would guess, I mean, the people in this room, for example, or whoever comes across your work,
yes.
they can't say, oh yes, that's just a bit of history. Because it's much more than that, because it seems to be infused with a real feeling,
mm-hmm.
which I think is very intelligent. Yeah, it's nice to hear intelligent. Intelligent. Thank you.
Thank you.
maybe I'm reading it wrong, because I thought they were very, like, the images were very romanticized, and that's why maybe some people would lend it to being nostalgic. But maybe I'm wrong, but I feel that there's still a sense of, I don't know, the ideas of looking at modernity and looking at the other side, it's also still a very Eurocentric kind of approach. I'm not really sure, but for example, like the Magician de l'Hotel exhibition, like Kirpur is also trying to do that in a kind of horizontal way. But maybe the contrast here where Dahran was putting kind of the periphery in the center, in the center with the numbers you showed of the Iranians being the majority. And so I'm just like trying to make all those, if it was still having like this Eurocentricism throughout this now idealization of that past. Maybe I'm completely wrong.
I could say something to give you some meat on your question, if you like, because there was a festival happening in Nancy in France during the same time at the university. So there was a theatre festival happening in France at the University of Nancy, and Jacques Lang, who's now actually the director of the Institut du Monde Arabe in Paris, and I think it was culture minister at some point. Was a director of it as a student. And he went to the Shiraz Festival. So you could say things, for example, that the Shiraz Festival existed within a network of other festivals that also were happening. For example, the Nancy Theatre Festival. More interestingly was the Belgrade Festival that was happening, that was a similar space to Shiraz. In no way is it in isolation. We were just speaking, and actually it was also mentioned about this very sophisticated network of people who are in contact. The Shiraz Persepolis Festival becomes very interesting because they are the ones who consciously articulate that we must stop the onslaught of the kind of inevitable Western takeover, if you like, or European influence on us. They articulated from a space that not only is not European, it's actually never been under the under some kind of colonial context either, because Iran was never a colony or a colonizer, so it's completely out of that. And they are very consciously articulating that. So Baalbek in Beirut had a festival. It's 12 years older than Shiraz. In fact, Shiraz Festival was partly dreamt of because of Baalbek in Beirut. But Baalbek never came to this point of, we have a mission, and the mission is to say the Asians and Africans must be somehow made equal. Let's do percussion, let's do ritual, let's do whatever we can to sort of create some link. Let's invite the Europeans, the Eastern, the Polish, the French, the Americans, whoever, who are interested in theatre as ritual or ritual as theatre. You see what I mean? They really became quite sophisticated in what they were doing. And that's what we're looking at. But more importantly, anti-nostalgia, anti-romanticization that you're saying, is the very interesting moment where on 28th of September 1977, there's a religious decree against the festival. The fact that it is isolated as a weak point is targeted as an easy target. It's stigmatized before much else is done. Is very, very important and very interesting, because it was already a complicated space. I haven't had time to discuss all of this, but it was very much, I said, a temporary autonomous zone. It was partly a temporary autonomous zone, i.e. it happened for 10 to 11 days a year, because even the Iranian secret service system couldn't bear more than 10 or 11 days. Yeah? So it was okay to be free for 10 or 11 days, but not much more than that. And the fact that the very ultra-left-wing intellectuals in Iran did not like the space, because it never articulated an overt anti-imperialism, despite all its positions as a third-world space that they were very, very keen on promoting, they never articulated an explicit anti-imperialist position. So the left, the hard left, didn't like them. And they were not producing theatre and performance for the factories or by the factory workers or for the peasants or by the peasants, right? So it was kind of deemed as superfluous by that part of the Iranian political community. So all of this stuff allowed the ones who were going to have this massive sort of axe to cut off as much as they can of cultural emancipation and freedom to target that first before they were going to expand that. Because in Iran, women cannot sing, a solo female singer still cannot sing in public, still today, 40 years later. They can as a chorus now. So it's been a step-by-step of trying to get back, you know, this going setbacks and going forward to the setbacks. But it was very serious. I mean, the fatwa was a very serious fatwa that affected performing arts and then arts and then culture and then the space of society as you expand. Do you see what I mean? So there, yeah. So, you know, it's very far removed, effectively, from anything romantic. It's, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the there's a particular moment in that where something happens over a decade and you can characterize it in a set of different ways, which in itself is interesting because it's not didactic. Mm-hmm. It's really experimental,
yes,
in a very contemporary way of being experimental. And it's affective rather than didactic and so on. But from the perspective of, let's say, a curator who invites that project into something that we're doing today, one of the things that you want to sort of think about is, are there archives of the possible, not just of the concrete? Mm-hmm. But so is what's being archived here a notion of the possible, not just, you know, this happened and that happened? And it's precisely because you can't quite characterize it. You can't quite say, oh, it's immensely progressive and third worldist, or it's nostalgic. And it's not possible to characterize it with kind of one term. That makes it interesting in the contemporary to say, oh, so what is it an archive of? And when I saw it the first time, I thought, this is the archive of the possible.
And aspirations.
And aspirations, yeah.
This was your term.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. It's fabulously stimulating. I just was struck by the comment you made, Vali, about pointing the finger, because it crystallised some things that I've thought when I've been seeing iterations of your project, which have been mostly in visual art spaces. Because it seems that it somehow encapsulates the way in which it sits kind of profoundly and very importantly, usefully, at odds with some of the kind of paradigms of exhibition making around Iran, around the Middle East, around places in the Middle East that it's sometimes been presented within. And I realise that's why I've always found it just completely stimulating. But I wanted to ask you, actually, thinking about that, to pick up on the term that you used in the title, which is the idea of post-representational curating, because that is one way of summing up the kind of a paradigm that's been very dominant for 15 years plus, in which Iran and other countries are brought into the kind of visual art space specifically. And it strikes me as very important that you're doing something that uses that ecology or that infrastructure, that does something very important on its own terms. I just wanted to ask you to expand on that term and sort of...
No, thanks, Ed. I mean, you said it, but in experiential terms, in terms, in sort of on the practical sphere, every time I do the project, I find that I need to massively compromise what I'm really doing. But when I'm doing it in the museum and the exhibition spaces, etc., in the institutions that are displaying the art, But when I'm doing it in the academic circles, for example, my connection with Irit at Whitechapel, it's always getting to the real core of the impulse and getting really to the core of the energy and the interest and the history and the intellect, etc., that's embodied in the kind of work I do. But I have to say, every time an exhibition happens, it's flattened in some one way or another. We're going to actually, recreating the Citadel project has been acquired by the Tate Modern, and is going to be shown from the end of this month. In fact, it was going to be opened from the 17th of July, so we thought it would already be open when I was asked to do the talk here at Mosaic Rooms, but it's going to open at the end of the month. So the documents that we see, we haven't been able to put all of them in for various reasons. But of course, what's important is that, you know, the project has arrived in a space like the Tate Modern, and it's been accepted into the fold, if you like, and I'm very pleased about that. But in these kind of projects, you have to always keep your own intentions and your own energies independent of the spaces that absorb you and the spaces that endorse you and the spaces that even exhibit you, or all of that, I have found. And the safest places are the academic spaces. And I've just recently lectured at Stanford University, I've done it at Bergen through Nora Stempel, and I've done it at the Goldsmiths because of Irit. Those are the spaces that you can really, and here tonight, you can really discuss the project. But when you actually, the materials produced physically for an audience is quite compromised often. So that's another area that I will have to look into, but instead of just getting upset about it,
yeah.
I have to study it.
Yeah, it's something that's shared by so many of us, which is when you produce stuff for the art world, it becomes art, and then it becomes subject to, you know, mechanisms of display, market forces, etc. So we need a practice that is between all of these things, but can't be captured by just one of them. And that's, it's very hard. It's really hard to find that space where something can operate in different ways, contradictory ways, kind of produce more than just what it's showing. And I agree with you. It's a kind of constant quest, but you're not alone,
yeah.
Right? You're not alone.
Should we drink to that, or is there a burning question?
No, because it's really interesting to understand where, for example, anxiety and for example, if they are going to choose, in a Citadel point of view, if they are going to choose the protest and the kind of political side of the project, or if actually they are going to choose the more human rights and the feminist side of the project when the feminist organization actually interacts in the Citadel side. So kind of choosing the location and having another curator maybe choosing that location kind of decontextualized the work in a way. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I do believe that an archive is such a great and bigger picture should be shown in their own, to don't give a choice to even make sort of wrong assumptions of what you are actually trying to say, mm-hmm. or actually what you are trying to connect, and not in just timetable, but as well in concepts. I think it's quite important for you to think about.
Yeah. It's true, and because I lived with this archive for a month in Norway, the sort of one of the things was that I kept constantly discovering conjunctions in it that I wasn't able to think of myself. And there was a poster that you had reconstructed, which was about Satyajit Ray and Ingmar Bergman together in 1973, and I thought, nowhere in the world was Satyajit Ray together with Ingmar Bergman in 1973. And it's that kind of conjunction, and then you think, okay, this isn't about national cultures or European alliances or whatever. There's avant-garde cinema, for sure, somewhere. But avant-garde cinema then becomes a vehicle for a series of comings together that are incredibly exciting. And it's that, and that's what an archive can produce. It can produce far beyond itself all the time. And that, I think, is the sort of really wonderful aspect of working archivally. And also inventing archivally. Because the archive is a parafiction, in a way, that sort of tells a story that then begins to tell other stories.
Yes, and that is how these projects, in a way, have happened, because the original interest I had was in the portraits of Kafagulistan. I thought they were photographically interesting. When I began the project, I realized that there was a lot of resistance. A lot of people didn't want to show them. There were spaces in London who rejected the exhibition as an exhibition on its own. I wasn't convinced. I thought these were very interesting photographs. And so I had to kind of retreat to into my hole and into my tunnel. And the retreat produced the archive.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there were 61 portraits. And, you know, if we have a room, we can show them. If we have two rooms, we can show all of them. But it was rejected. Sometimes it was rejected because it was deemed political, sometimes like politically sensitive. Sometimes it was rejected because it wasn't commercial enough. It wasn't saleable. Are there editions attached? And institutionally, it was rejected because it was nice, a good idea, but.
But it's also it's a deeply ambivalent project. It kind of demonstrates a whole set of ambiguities around the subject.
Yes.
And so, I think that's one of the reasons why there was this kind of hesitation around it. And for an archive to perform ambiguity is a serious achievement, I think. Archives normally perform certainty. That's what they're there for, is to perform certainty.
Now, that's what I really realized from the very beginning of what joined the project together was this archaeology of the final decade. It wasn't the name or the institution or the idea that produced the project. The project produced the title, and the title now is quite abstract enough, at least thank God, because I don't really want to be constrained to this, limited to this space, because some people think the last decade is the last decade before the fall of the Berlin Wall. Some people think the last decade is the last decade before 9/11. So we are going to have a lot of last decades coming up, so hopefully I can continue using this title in an abstract way. Even the last decade before the advent of AIDS. So it's great. We can do a lot of work with this last decade. But it came through the projects. It wasn't an idea in the beginning. And of course, initially it refers to the last decade before the Iranian Revolution. But the point of convergence and the point of intersection between my projects is what created this whole archive, this whole investigative process, this forensic process. Otherwise, I was going to do an exhibition of portraits, and I was also really interested in this theatre project. And but the blocks and the hesitations and the resistances towards the projects pushed me backwards in order to come up again with another way of doing them. That's really the history of how it happened, anyway.
Anybody else want to say anything? So what's on the agenda now?
Well,
No, actually, I didn't mean about your work event this evening.
Oh.
Are they going to invite us for a drink?
Yes, I don't know. Are there drinks? Yeah. Okay. Yes, there must be.
There's somebody waving a glass at us from the back, so there must be.
Somebody knows the system. Yes, there's a bar open.
We should.
Yeah, great.
Okay.
Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Valley.
Thank you, Reed.